Welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable. Reasoned?
Sure.
Reasoned Roundtable, your weekly antidote to political apocalypticism from the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy No More White Shoes Day.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Nope.
Happy Tuesday.
Peter. Peter, can you check Catherine's footwear?
So just I'm wearing white shoes, and she is not.
I'm wearing boots, like God intended, on the day after Labor Day.
We're going to talk about Joe Biden's weird speech in Philadelphia here in a moment. But first, slurping noises from Nick Gillespie. But first, looking for a podcast that does not involve any of the current participants of the Reason Roundtable? Well, have I got a doozy for you. It's hosted by Oklahoma's favorite funnyman and a longtime Reason contributor, Andrew Ever-Lovin' Heaton. The Political Orphanage is his podcast, designed for people who don't feel at home in the Republican or Democratic parties. Rather than explaining issues as political slap fights, Heaton looks for the underlying problems to the biggest issues, all while keeping you amused. This month, Heaton flew to Berlin to interview a historian about Nazi economics and whether Hitler was a socialist or a capitalist. Over the next 2 weeks, he's going to ask comedians about whether social justice is a religion. And later this month, he's doing a special on what all happens in the event of thermonuclear war. It's a funny, smart, nonpartisan show with swell guests, and it's hosted by Andrew Heaton. Check out The Political Orphanage today. You'll be glad you did. All right, on Thursday night, President Joseph Robinette Biden stood in front of an ominously lit Independence Hall in Philadelphia and delivered a stern warning that American democracy is at an inflection point, one of those moments that determines the shape of everything that comes after. At issue, the president claimed, was whether MAGA Republicans, a formulation he used 10 times, are going to fan the flames of political violence and embrace authoritarianism to the point where the very soul of this country is up for grabs. Speech, which was not carried by major television networks, also included a laundry list of Democratic Party initiatives, including infrastructure spending, the Inflation Reduction Act, Made in America trade provisions, and so forth. Critics of the address, including Reason's own Elizabeth Nolan Brown, Jacob Sullum, and J.D. Tuccilli, charged that it sounded too much like a campaign speech, conflating normal political disagreements with an apocalyptic struggle between good and evil, while never once pointing out that Democrats, too, have some issues with political violence and not accepting the results of elections. Catherine, I feel like this thing was kind of scripted for an audience of media critics with recently canceled shows and or historians who like to go on MSNBC rather than people who might be persuaded that there's things that we must do to combat authoritarianism. What was your read?
My read was that this was a campaign speech, and I don't like it when presidents do primetime national addresses to give campaign speeches. I don't think that that's what those are for, but I don't think it was also terribly unusual. I think the sort of freak out about it was disproportionate. And I will say, if what Biden was trying to do was say, like, hey, you know, is the other side, the MAGAs, are they like uniquely bad and maybe doing weird bad things to the discourse, and then that quote unquote other side collectively lost their minds about the fact that there was red lighting behind him, and that was the one and only takeaway from the speech, I wouldn't have gone with that as my rebuttal. But that's where we ended up in the discourse. I mean, I did not watch it in real time, so I watched it later after I had already seen the lighting shows Biden is a Nazi commentary, and the lighting doesn't show Biden is a Nazi. Biden is not a Nazi. Neither are the MAGAs, in my view. But
it was very reminiscent of the First Order speeches from the new Star Wars trilogy, though.
I did not. I think you and I might be on slightly different Twitter because I did not see that one.
Peter, you live in D.C. Tell me what, at this point, is the most unshakable article of faith among Democratic Washington? That one, everything's going to turn around when we do that one big speech, or that two, every speech, in fact, requires a laundry list of boring Democratic Party legislative initiatives.
I mean, this is a huge problem with that speech, is that Biden effectively conflated lack of support for the complete Democratic Party agenda as being a dangerous and violence-supporting MAGA Republican. And that's why I found this speech not just bad, but kind of disturbing. It basically, it on the one hand, sort of made a token attempt at the top to say, well, look, I'm not talking about all Republicans. And then the laundry list of Democratic accomplishments and proposals that he sticks into this, you know, sort of two thirds of the way through the speech, ends up saying, look, if you're not with me on spending precisely $370 billion on combating climate change and adjusting the corporate tax code in exactly this way, then you might as well be a MAGA Trump supporter. And that's wrong. It's not just that, like, I don't like it. It's not just that I don't agree with that. That's just wrong. And it is, I think, a really telling tick that Democrats have done this and used this sort of rhetorical conflation maneuver since at least the Obama era, where they say, well, look, you know, we don't believe that everybody on the other side is bad. And what we'd like to do is bring the people who aren't bad over, you know, to our side, at least to find some common ground, you know, to defeat the really fringe elements. And the common ground is only the things that we already believe, and you get nothing out of that. It's a terrible way to win friends. And it also is a terrible way to actually go about prosecuting a case against, if you believe there is a really dangerous faction in American politics, then what you should be doing is not saying, well, look, the option is either join that dangerous faction and be part of it or totally support our agenda. You should be saying, let's find common ground and let's find places to compromise. And there's no place for compromise there. And what that suggests to me is that Biden doesn't actually believe all of this. He doesn't act as if he believes that the MAGA forces, which, man, what an interesting turn of phrase, because it actually makes them sound kind of cool.
Makes them sound cool.
Right?
It was like, a huge mistake.
Just stupid and terrible to do that. MAGA forces, my God.
It's like it's the exact same trick that Trump used with Space Force.
Yeah, which is going well.
So if you think that MAGA forces are truly dangerous, if you think that MAGA forces are truly dangerous, you shouldn't be leading a party that is spending millions of dollars to elevate MAGA candidates in down ballot races, which the Democratic Party is doing. You shouldn't be passing a massive illegal handout in the form of the student loan forgiveness program, which was illegal, according to Nancy Pelosi. Right. You shouldn't be doing stuff like that. And you should be trying to find some sort of common ground with the people who you think you can work with on the other side. Biden did none of that, which just tells you he doesn't take this seriously, and therefore we shouldn't either.
Nick, Donald Trump, who is still the most popular figure and certainly the most impactful in the Republican Party right now, has over the past week or so said that he would pardon people convicted in the January 6th riot in Capitol Hill. He's reposted memes by QAnon. And he wrote, quote, the presidential election was badly, that's going to be all caps, that's my all caps voice, and irreparably tainted by the FBI's fake description of the laptop from hell to Facebook and lamestream media. Declare the rightful winner or hold a new election now. Maybe this is.
Yeah, I would like a new 2020 election would be what solves everything.
I mean, maybe he is a threat to democracy, Nick Gillespie, requiring a presidential, intervention.
Yeah, I don't think he is a threat to democracy, but there's no question that, MAGA Republicans, 80% of Trump's, he supported or endorsed 159 candidates in the current election cycle. 80% of them have won. All of them deny that Joe Biden won the 2020 election. So there's something going on there. And according to 538, out of 529 Republican nominees for office in this election cycle, 195 deny outright. Another 61 have raised additional questions about the election of 2020. So there's a large portion of people in America, particularly Trump-supporting Republicans, who say that Biden is not the legitimate president, which is problematic. It's problematic in the same way when Democrats would not acknowledge that Donald Trump was the president. That's, yeah, I think that's that, you know, this is not good to live in a country which depends on elections to create a representative government, and you have larger and larger numbers of people, you know, saying that the
do
elections
y'all think this
are
speech
no good.
Made any dent in that? I mean, I it felt totally inconsequential to me. Maybe I'm just in a Scott Shackford kind of mood, I'm looking for the news not to be news, which I appreciate in him.
So that you're pushing needles in your toes just to see if you feel anything at all.
That's not how I perceive our colleague Scott Shackford, but okay.
Well, you're the one who brings him up as an unfeeling
what
lump
in
of
God's name.
Ectoplasm,
I was saying that
something.
He's calm.
I agree. I agree with you. This speech is inconsequential. He was speaking to his base.
The fully convinced.
And
yeah.
Biden, who is still, again, according to 538, which gives him more, you know, credit than Real Clear Politics, he's at 42.8% approval rating at RCP. He's at 42%. This is a very unpopular president who's coming off of a couple of good weeks in the summer. He decided to, you know, take advantage of the old sets from Amazon's Man in the High Castle before they get thrown out to give a speech where he gets to act like he's living in, you know, the Nazi-occupied America in that show. And nobody watched it. I mean, it wasn't even on real. It, you know, it's not like anybody watches TV anymore, but this was not on broadcast TV. So I feel it is disturbing to me the large percentage of Americans who are going to go along. It's a kind of analog of quiet quitting. There's going to be 40% of Americans from here on out for the rest of our lives who just say, you know what, all of these elections are fake and the president has never actually been elected. I'm curious to see how this plays out after the midterms when the Democrats lose the House resoundingly. They may keep the Senate, which would complicate their narrative that the House elections are fake, because there's going to be a large group of Democrats who refuse to acknowledge the loss of the House in the fall. And if it gets to 40%, I think then, you know, we have a real serious epistemological problem in this country. Otherwise, this is a slow news week that Biden is trying to you know, kind of take advantage.
Catherine, Nick's political prognosticating aside, there is let's focus on his, you know, talking about Democrats who have refused in places to acknowledge elections, Stacey Abrams being probably the most famous avatar. That's certainly not hard to find clips of Hillary Clinton saying some pretty, like, Donald Trump is an illegitimate president. Even me saying this, I feel like I'm hearing Brendan Nyhan jumping into my brain, saying that I'm engaging in both sidesism and whataboutism. What is your response to that criticism, that even us bringing up things like that, yes, this does happen among Democrats, as does political violence, which, you know, many times Biden said in the speech, we should never, ever, ever condone or look the other way on political violence. There has been political violence in this country over the past 5, 6, 7 years that it's emanated from the left side of the political spectrum. Is even bringing that up in the context of Biden's speech kind of improper? Is it using both sidesism and not acknowledging the asymmetry in kind of the madness of politics right now?
I mean, I think you could do both sidesism and put an asterisk on it. And I think that's what's appropriate here. So, you know, I would say there is, I think there's a very clear case to be made that Trump has been more, let's say, boorish, and that Trump's supporters have been more violent than their counterparts on the left and in the Democratic Party in recent memory. So it's a little worse, for sure. I don't think they are they're not sui generis, right? We've talked many times on this podcast about how polarization is increasing in ways that in particular seem to lead people on, dare I say, both sides to condone or increasingly support violence against people they disagree with. I think that's a sort of troubling trend. But that trend is both sides. It is happening in the Democratic and Republican bases. So it's not, you know, I think the thing that you're getting at, and which I think is important, is it is not our job to only tell the stories that serve the ends that the, you know, people who know better, quote unquote, want told. That's not our deal. The next issue of the magazine has a story about how American elections have always been a mess. And we thought a lot about whether that was the right story to tell at this moment. But it's important information to know, because the next election is going to be a mess. And you have to know going into it, is this new? Because it's going to be a hyper focus. People are going to be obsessed with every little, you know, grit and grain of sand in this process. And it's important to keep in context that it's always been a mess, and there's always been gerrymandering. There's always been manipulation at the ballot box. There's always been crappy rhetoric. There's always been somebody who sends out a mailer that says the election day is on a different day. There are so many things that go wrong. Now, I will say, historically and globally, our elections are still really good, by and large. And that's worth keeping in mind, too. But yeah, I think both sidesism is appropriate, in part because I think it tamps down what will be absolutely crazy rhetoric around each and every little failing of our election system in the next cycle.
We have danced around this a little bit already, but Catherine's talking about the question here being whether it's right to only advance narratives that, like, the certain people think are the good and true ones. Matt, you've mentioned, you know, media critics. Nick talked about this being a speech for Biden's base, but I think there was a very specific base that Biden was aiming at. And that's intellectuals who are concerned about right-wing threats to democracy, and very particularly historians. And I think the historians got to him. And they've been getting to him his entire presidency. So if you guys remember back when Biden was first coming into office, it was around January 2020 or so. I don't remember exactly the date. There were stories about how Biden was meeting with historians, and they were saying, look, you know, you might be the next LBJ, and this might be the moment to do Great Society too, and to sort of bring that back. And Biden spent a lot of his first year kind of trying to do that. And then just last month, on August 10th, The Washington Post ran a story, and I'm just going to read you the headline and the subhead. Historians privately warn Biden that America's democracy is teetering. When Biden met with historians last week at the White House, they compared the threat facing America to pre-Civil War era and pro-fascist movements before World War II. And I think Biden just bought that, and he believes that he is the man for the moment to lead us out of this you know, tense situation in which democracy is truly under threat. And, you know, everybody who listens to this podcast knows I view Trump as unqualified for the presidency, as just a kind of awful person. I think January 6th and the Trump-led campaign to rig or overturn or deny the 2020 election is pretty clearly worse than any specific thing, you know, that you might point to that Democrats have done, even though I also think it's worth pointing out the things that Democrats have done to deny elections. But Biden's speech was just so transparently cynical and not very convincing, even to someone who is open to the idea that Trump is a special kind of awful. And I worry, we talked about the consequences. Some of you said, well, maybe this will just, you know, it'll be a big nothing burger. I actually worry that the consequence here is that this is going to end up focusing people on Trump and elevating Trump and uniting parts of the Republican base behind him in a moment where perhaps he could have been beaten and taken off the
stage. So are you saying, though, Peter, are you saying that Biden believes the historians and that he is uniquely the man for the role, but that his speech is cynical, so he doesn't really believe when he calls out MAGA Republicans as an actual threat to?
I'm saying he both believes it, and then his actions do not support someone who really believes that. Do not seem to be sort of tactically the kind of actions that you would take.
What would he take otherwise? If he believed it, what would he be doing?
Just to interrupt, but I mean, his proposed solution in the speech, there was one, and it was vote, vote, vote. And
it was vote Democrat and back the Democratic agenda.
And I mean, I think you would look for the Electoral Reform Act and the negotiations that are happening on Capitol Hill about that. You might hyper focus on a couple of particularly problematic people running for consequential office right now. The Republican candidate for governor in Pennsylvania comes to mind.
Wait, so Biden should have called out the gubernatorial case in case, Pennsylvania and said, this guy, and you wouldn't be like, oh, that's...
No, I mean...
I don't understand the critique. I don't think Biden is being cynical here. I think he believes what he's saying. I think there's some truth to, you know, the fact he is part of the problem by articulating it in this term, but it's also, you know, Trump has never officially accepted that he won in 2016 because Trump has said that he would have won the popular vote by
a wide majority. Votes.
So it's, you know, and again, there's that if you go back and you look at 2000 and 2004, Democrats were pissed, and particularly in 2004, they advance, and these are people in the Senate and in the House who are still in politics today, advanced an argument that the 2004 reelection of George Bush was illegitimate because of specific electoral chicanery in places like Ohio, and it had to do with voting machines and things like that. In 2016, you know, and then that went away, both on the Republican and the Democratic side for a while. Then when Trump won, they started advancing arguments that were less about, well, Trump didn't actually get those votes, but that the whole Electoral College is bullshit and that this is, you know, the slave power still existing. And that's a different type of argument that's fucked up. And Hillary also, you know, is her own thing, but she's been kind of quarantined in the Democratic Party. She doesn't have the kind of power Trump has now. And so, you know, what we're talking about here, there is a both sides to this, but it's also Trump is the one who is advancing the idea that there are literally millions of votes that have been stolen from him and given to Joe Biden. And that is one order of argument, which is completely false. Every investigation of it, and there have been, you know, dozens of them all over the country, has shown that to be false. And I think the thing that I'm worried about now is that the Democrats are going to resurrect their 2004 arguments, and then they're going to advance them, you know, when they lose the House, and if, God forbid, if they lose the presidency in 2024, they're going to start saying it's not simply that the whole Electoral College is bullshit and the Constitution needs to be written and gerrymandering is bad, but that armed goons have stolen votes and things like that.
All right,
that.
We're going to get quickly to a thing that's happening in California today, which is to say that today in California, again, being battered by triple-digit heat wave in the midst of a mega drought, it's projected to experience today, Tuesday, the single greatest single-day demand for electricity in state history. Officials are begging residents not to use air conditioning and other power gobbling implements, worried that otherwise we're going to see yet again rolling blackouts. This stress comes 2 weeks after California instituted a future ban in 2035 on the sale of gasoline-powered cars. And it comes 1 week after Governor Gavin Newsom signed a law that reauthorized nuclear power in the state. Catherine, is it fair just to look at blackouts anywhere for any reason other than a military strike on power generation as a government failure?
I would like to do that. I don't actually think it's quite fair. And one sort of counterexample that I think I've seen raised with some justice is in Texas, where there has been a lot of privatization, and they are suffering from similar problems. Now, you might say, okay, you know, you just need to look one layer deeper for the government failure in that case, that the privatization process, the contracting process was messed up. They were still constrained by a just absolutely vast regulatory net. I think that's true, but I also think, you know, private providers of services fail too. And so I am, you know, cautious about kind of reductio ad libertarianum or something there. But is what's happening in California a government failure? Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, yes. And in the spirit of some of our previous conversations about how actually every story is zoning, That's at least it's a non-zero part of what's going on in California. Nobody wants it in their backyard. Nobody wants to build out capacity. And when you subject that question to the democratic or quasi-democratic process, you get insufficient capacity. Like, there you go. If the people don't want it and we agree the people get a say, they don't get it. And of course, final note, prices. What if prices contained information? What if electricity prices were allowed to reflect demand? That would be like a cool way of rationing electricity and literally all other goods. And it wouldn't feel like rationing. It would feel like people making private individual choices about how much money they want to spend on electricity and purchasing energy efficient appliances and otherwise prioritizing low energy use if the price of energy reflected the cost of energy.
Peter, the Democratic Party in particular has been talking about the last 15, 20 years about we're going to get the 5 million green jobs, the future. We're going to do the clean energy in America first and all of this stuff. California relies heavily on solar power. And it's super hot and sunny, and they're going to run out of power today. Is this the...
Ironically, when it's
super
very
hot and sunny outside. Is this the year, given that, given the mega drought in the West, given the Russia-Ukraine war and the pinching that is doing on natural gas supplies and oil supplies in general, is this a year where magical thinking kind of goes to die when it comes to the environment? All these sort of, 20 years from now, we're going to have zero something type of policies that we've seen widespread in particularly democratic polities and then also in many places in Western Europe. Are they just butting up against a reality so that now, Joe Biden has to go to Saudi Arabia, which he said was a pariah state before. Now he's begging them to drill oil and such.
I think the worry is that 20 years from now, the zero something we're going to have is energy. Just not going to have any of it left. It's going to be,
spiritually or like.
Like all of the.
Like in Marianne Williamson sense.
All of the above. The crystals okay. aren't going to work. Okay. Like my chakra is going to be gone.
Yeah.
But also you're not going to be able to fill up your electric vehicle at the government charging station that the Biden energy plan didn't end up building. It's obviously not going to be the year that magical thinking goes to die because this is the year that California said we are not going to have any more gasoline-powered cars after 2035, I believe it is. And yet, right after that, they also said, hey, folks, you might want to consider not charging your electric vehicles. Like, if you're going to tell everybody that they have to have electric vehicles and only electric vehicles, then you need to let people charge those vehicles. Obviously, they're not saying that you can't charge them, in 2035 at this point, but this is sort of the path that they've been on. The Democratic Party, the sort of the left in writ large, has never had, or at least has not in my lifetime, had a coherent vision for an energy future for America, because they have said, on the one hand, that higher prices are great. And then every time we have higher prices, they want to subsidize things to make prices lower. They have said that, green energy is great. And then they've erected, for environmental reasons, a bunch of barriers to building green energy. Eric Boehm has a story about how government has proven a burden to building wind farms offshore, right? Just in the past couple of weeks here at Reason. This is the Democratic Party wants something on energy, but they don't know what it is. They just know that whatever the current situation is, they're against it, and they want it to be good and better and different. And it's totally incoherent. I think you see that happening right now in California, and I think you're going to continue to see that happening for the next decade or two.
Nick, last week's decision, overwhelming vote in California legislature to reauthorize nuclear power and the San Diablo plant. Boy, man, a lot of libertarians and other people have been talking about this for decades. And then it finally happens. Ron Bailey is doing cartwheels as we speak.
Which also means he's going to be in the hospital for the next 6 months recovering from cartwheels.
We should stop the habit of talking about our colleagues on this podcast. Is there any lesson to be gleaned by the long, slow, and then sudden victory of kind of sensible, free market oriented or libertarian oriented policy victories?
That's a great question because, the idea, hopefully you could chill out because you know in the end it's going to be all right. But a lot of the times you don't. So, it's like you're always, I think politics is a Peter Bagg cartoon, to name check another reason regular. It's flop sweat all the time. You can never be, his characters to me are personified, by sweating all of the time, no matter what. And that's what politics is because, in the end, the right decision might be reached, but you can't be sure. I think it's, between California recognized, California is, according to Michael Schellenberger and other people who follow this closely, is the largest natural gas producer possibly in the world, certainly in the United States. But they shut a lot of that down because it didn't fit into their idea of renewable or sustainable or bridge fuels to the future. That's one of the reasons why they have an electricity problem right now. But they're willing to keep, nuclear power plants open. When you throw that in with the winter that Europe is facing because of the Ukraine-Russia war, Germany is rethinking its rejection of nuclear power. There's a ton of new nuclear technology that's on, that is available right now that will also hopefully circumvent some of the enormous amount of government subsidies that have gone into the nuclear industry, particularly in the United States, because we chose a really particularly stupid top-down approach during the Cold War when this stuff first became available. A lot of that might be changing. And I suspect that in 5 or 10 years, we won't be talking about energy the way that we are now, because between nuclear and a bunch of other stuff that doesn't get discussed right now because it doesn't have political interests like wind and solar, we're not going to be worrying about energy anymore because there's so much technology that would allow us to have abundant, cheap, if not free, non-polluting energy. And we're going to turn the corner and there it'll be. And, it'll be like libertarians talking about the post office. It will not matter whatsoever.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp.com. Question: in times of stress and challenge and flop sweat, like, say, the first week of school and you still don't know where your 14-year-old daughter is attending, do you tend to focus more on the problem or on the solution? People in arduous circumstances tend to get all fight or flighty. But therapists are there to help them, to help you reset the brain into problem-solving mode. That's where BetterHelp.com comes in. Friends, there's nothing worthless or weak about seeking third-party assistance and helping you address life's challenges. BetterHelp is customizable online therapy, super convenient and affordable, and ready right now to set you up with a professional counselor to help you turn your brain into a problem-solving machine. Go to BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Fill out a brief questionnaire and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Go there today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Mike Saliba, a congressional candidate in Michigan's District 10 for the Libertarian Party. He writes, "Hello all. Whenever I am having a conversation with a diehard Trump cultist for long enough, I ask the question, why? Why do you love him so much? What did he actually do for you? He didn't follow through on any campaign promises. He went the opposite direction on several. If I'm speaking with someone who has a more nuanced response than he talks shit to people I don't like, it's something like he did a lot of deregulation, but they can never name anything specific that was deregulated. I know Trump did lead some deregulation, but I'm not sure how much made a big difference. I started thinking about the deregulation under Jimmy Carter that I do know about, everything from airlines to beer brewing. So now my question is it possible that Jimmy Carter did more and better deregulation than Donald Trump? And how could we measure this?" I'll just quickly say to the how could we measure question, as always, refer to the Competitive Enterprise Institute's annual report, The 10,000 Commandments, which painstakingly measures the number of regulations, the number of economically significant ones. They measure how much they are projected to impose costs on the private economy, and a bunch of other things besides, obviously, the number of pages in the Federal Registry. Check that out. Their last one, I think, is only from last year, June of 2021. So we're waiting for the next one, but that's always the best initial place to go. Nick, he said Jimmy Carter and deregulation, so that means you have to talk now.
Yeah, I don't know what to say, Matt. You mentioned airlines and home brewing, throw in interstate trucking, and Jimmy Carter is forgiven for all of the Habitat for Humanity stuff that he's done. And for kissing Yasser Arafat and Muammar Gaddafi and ogling their wives, which he was also famous for.
Catherine, in areas that you pay close attention to, where did you see Trump succeeding, failing, or being kind of meh when it came to deregulation?
Yeah, so I will remind you that we did a cover of Reason Magazine that had Trump's picture on it and the words "the deregulator?" question mark. And that question mark ended up doing a lot of work. And, you know, I actually think he didn't turn out to be too much of a deregulator. He did turn out to be a not regulator, which is an interesting thing, right? Like, there's an alternate timeline that so many people love to travel, the like, but Hillary would have been worse timeline, that clearly contains a massive uptick in regulations in basically every area over the 4 years of Trump's term. And I think that that's not enough of a reason to, for instance, have voted for him a second time. But I do think it's real. I think, like, many, many, many people that I know, because like Peter Suderman, I live in Washington, D.C., who work for the federal government, were bitterly angry that for the 4 years of his presidency, they weren't really allowed to do their jobs where their jobs were: write, refine, enforce, and otherwise push the envelope on various regulations. So that is a real thing that happened. It's hard to quantify. It's hard to fully grasp because it relies on a counterfactual. And so we don't have the Hillary Clinton presidency to compare Trump's to, though living in both of those worlds sounds bad. But was he a deregulator? Not so much. Was he a no new regulations for 4 whole years, which is kind of valuable because that was 4 whole years that those industries had a chance to breathe a little bit? Yeah, I think there's something there.
Yeah, I would just second that if the question is, how do we measure this? It's really hard.
And also just ask CEI.
but to the extent that it can be done, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is the place where I first worked when I came to Washington, I was there as a deputy editor for about a year and a half in the mid-aughts. They do the best job of any organization, I think, just in trying to answer this very specific question of how do we quantify the volume of regulation that is present in any given year and that is created in any given year. And so I will just read you one and only one sentence from one of the 10,000 Commandments reports, which is their annual report on the state of federal regulation. So this is talking about the Trump presidency, the slowed pace of traditional rulemaking. And that's Catherine's point, which is they didn't make as many new rules as other administrations typically do. And that's the slowed pace of traditional rulemaking, as opposed to Trump's sweeping impulses on antitrust, trade, tech policy, family leave, social policy, and other areas that are not easily tracked in OMB reviews, was a major development defining the Trump administration. So what does that tell you? It tells you that in some ways, the Trump administration did less regulation than other administrations. On the other hand, they also did a lot of stuff. And you can't really go in and say, oh, look, this was a small government presidency. That's not how you would define the Trump era at all, especially when you consider all of the COVID spending and et cetera that came out of the last year. On the other hand, you can imagine ways. Maybe the best way to think about it is that at least for the first 3 years of the Trump presidency, you certainly could imagine the regulatory regime being much worse.
So as the author of the Deregulator cover story, the prediction in that piece, and I was surprised to hear so many people who follow this issue find him to be, at that time, is the really literally the first months of his presidency, very promising on that. And so wrote it out. And the warning by those people were like, he's got good people around him. He's come up with an idea to eliminate two regulations for every one new one going in. And at first, people were including me, were a little bit scoffy at that. But it turned out to have some teeth into it. But they all warned, and this gets to the question, that executive action without corresponding legislative action. Real deregulation happens when Congress says, you know what, we no longer do this thing to airlines. This act that we passed in 1930 no longer applies. This board, the Civil Aeronautics Board, we are going to make it go away now. And this came after, and this is under multiple presidencies, even Gerald Ford a little bit, but specifically Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. They held hearings, many of them with prominent Democrats like Ted Kennedy chairing them. They built up a sense of popular support and testimony. Those changes were largely legislative. You can do some things. You can wave the magic wand as president, but then the next president gets to wave his magic wand, and it turns out that there's a bit of a wash in that process. I'll read from the 2021 issue of the 10,000 Commandments. The Trump era highlighted the limits of regulatory reform when done unilaterally, even by a committed executive branch, because the ability to constrain the administrative state is limited both by onerous procedures and the ability of a future president to unilaterally reverse a predecessor's executive orders. So one way of thinking about this is that the Centers for Disease Control under Donald Trump enforced a moratorium on evictions. That's not a super deregulatory moment. And also, Trump helped bring back and popularize among Republicans a thirst for antitrust enforcement that we haven't seen from them in a very long time, particularly on media and technology companies. We're going to be probably dealing with a fallout from that going forward. And also, trade restrictionism is a form of regulation. You are regulating people's ability to trade with one another. And that's something that sadly the Trump and Biden administrations both hold together. So
Just add, Matt, that if you're talking to a Trump cultist, though, you're not going to convince them of any of this. And the best thing you can do is say, thank you. I'll take my Arby's to go when you're talking to them. And start having conversations with people who are, who are capable of actually engaging and having conversation. And I don't mean that to be as dismissive as it is, but that's, I'm saying, like, if, somebody who is a committed Trumpist, they're not changing their mind. You're wasting your breath talking to them. Try to have a conversation about the weather or something that you both might agree on, but it's not going to be anything substantive.
Keep in mind the questioner is running for office. He's running for office.
No, in a state that
actually
is,
have to talk to people, Nick.
Yeah, he should be committing to the people who are not Trump cultists. They're going to vote Republican.
I also think there's a difference between, hey, should we do interpersonal interactions about politics where we try to understand each other and be understood? I'm an idiot. Maybe I should, get out of the Wendy's and the Arby's. But like, I think it is still worth talking to people in like one-on-one about stuff, especially if they want to talk about it, right? And you feel like maybe you have some way in, which is what this questioner is asking, at least in part. I think that is a little bit of a different thing than the thing that I find most mysterious, which is, God forgive me for this archaic terminology, but the mainstream media's ongoing wellspring of hope that this scandal or finding or stack of papers or videotape is the thing that is finally going to convince people that Trump is actually not great. And I think on the large scale, that's not going to happen, or at least it's not going to happen with any of these things that people have put forth as candidate mind changers. Like there of course, there's some amount of discovered video that would, in fact, eventually reduce Trump's support. But, this constant...
He didn't properly follow federal document procurement rules.
This constant over and over, like, this is the one breaking countdown on CNN. And it's like, this isn't the one. That's not the one. And so on that level, I do think it's right to kind of say, you know, there's not going to be this headline that changes everyone's mind. But there might well be a conversation that softens or complicates one person's views.
All right. Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural production sphere. Peter, yeah, do you want to lead us
off? I watched the movie 3,000 Years of Longing. It's a genie film by George Miller, the guy who made the Mad Max movies, and also the Babe films, the ones about the talking pigs. Because George Miller is just like such a delightful creator of things, where he's like, okay, I'm going to spend my 30s making just super angry, like post-apocalyptic Mel Gibson, you know, stunt films. And then I'm going to, you know, after I get a little bit older, I'm going to make some like really like gentle and nice and cute looking movies for kids starring animated talking pigs. Then we'll go back to the Mad Max thing. And then in my late 60s, I'm going to make a movie about storytelling and wishes and the relationship between narrative and science. And this is, I think, the thing that I want to pull out of this for reason type listeners, people who are interested in our set of ideas, is that there are a lot of movies out there that are about romanticism. And in their romanticism, they kind of reject a scientific view of the world. But this movie fuses romanticism and like the ideas of progress and science in a way that's really innovative and really neat, because what it basically says is that for a long time, humans didn't have much in the way of science, and so we explained the world through stories. Now we explain most of the world through science, and science becomes the story we are telling about ourselves. At the same time, science can't quite explain everything, or at least not yet, and in particular, it can't explain the yearnings in our hearts for connection with other people. And so it's great to live in a world in which science has given us a lot, but we still need stories and we still need to tell stories because fundamentally they're like, we all have these sort of hidden deep desires lurking within us. It's a great, weird, fantastic, trippy movie. If you like George Miller, if you like genie movies, if you like crazy visuals, strongly recommend it.
Matt, you're a big Kazam fan, right? The Shaq genie movie?
No.
No?
What have you consumed?
I consumed two things, one of which I'll discuss in detail, but this first one in passing was Catherine Mangu Ward's TED Talk, which is available online and is a delight. And I don't know if we're posting it somewhere at Reason, but we certainly should. So Google TED Talk, Catherine Mangu Ward, and what's it, Catherine, like 7.5 minutes, 8 minutes, something like that?
It's the full 12, my guy.
Okay. So, well, you know what? It felt like 8 minutes.
Thank you.
Because it was so,
thank you,
know,
so it was, much.
It was power packed. So there's that. But then a couple of weeks ago in Florida, there was a congressional candidate, a Democrat named Maxwell Frost, who became the first Gen Z finalist for a congressional office, and he's in a district where he's almost certainly going to win. So there were a spate of stories about the, you know, this is
that his superhero alter ego name?
Well, Maxwell Frost. I was like, Maxwell Frost, that sounds familiar. And there's a great shitty movie from 1968 called Wild in the Streets, where a power mad rock star named Max Frost, who has a band called Max Frost and the Troopers, steals power basically from Hal Holbrook, who is a senator, a congressman running for Senate who needs the youth vote. So he enlists Max Frost to be his spokesman. And then Max Frost goes rogue and starts a campaign to make the vote 15. Like if you're 15, you can vote. And eventually Max Frost becomes president and then ends up putting anybody over 30, including his mother, played by Shelley Winters, in concentration camps where they're the old people wear basically like graduation gowns because Shelley Winters is getting a little bit flabby. This is 1968. And dose them with LSD to make them docile. And I just want to tell you right now, so Wild in the Streets is coming true, just like, you know, Joseph Schumpeter's understanding that capitalism will destroy itself is coming true 70 years after he articulated that critique. Wild in the Streets is coming true about 50 years after it was first filmed. You can watch it on Amazon Prime. It is a fantastic movie that just every time you hear like hippie or something, swap in Gen Z. And it is a roadmap to what's going to be happening for the next 5 to 6 years in
America. Catherine, there's no way you can top
that. I mean,
but what a chicken soup.
There really isn't. Like, I honestly don't know what just happened.
I mean, what are the odds? What are the odds that Maxwell Frost is like the first youth candidate? I mean, it's over.
I read a short book. I honestly don't know what to do here. I read a short book called Why It's Okay to Want to Be Rich by Jason Brennan. He is a friendly neighborhood ethicist in our general orbit here in DC libertarian universe. And the book is delightful. It's part of a series of Why It's Okay books. We excerpted one a while back, Why It's Okay to Ignore Politics by Chris Fryman. And I really enjoyed it. It's like a great, if you just want like a nice, dare I say, TED Talk-ish style, kind of quick argument that just goes through the strongest arguments, the strongest objections to things that people kind of unthinkingly condemn and revisits them. Jason Brennan does a really good job. Why It's Okay to Want to Be Rich.
Boom. All right. Mine, I watched with my entire family movie night. So that's, you know, fraught when you have a 7-year-old and 14-year-old in the house. And we had a successful experience.
Not another pretty baby viewing.
Successful viewing of a Disney movie that gets forgotten, or at least somehow just like doesn't get thrown in your face as much as the other ones, called Atlantis: The Lost Empire. I think it's Disney's 41st production, for those of you who like to keep score of that. Came out 2001, it's, you know, a silly Michael J. Fox voiced nerdy scientist who's the grandson of somebody and blah blah blah, and he goes and finds Atlantis, and James Garner, Nick, plays the mercenary heavy.
Yep. Rockfish.
Yep. Rockfish.
That was what Isaac Hayes used to refer to him as.
It was surprisingly very good. If sort of, I love that little period in Disney. The Hunchback of Notre Dame is another one that came out 5 years before that. I think it was the immediately preceding one. That animation, those ones are really kind of interesting, and it's strange that they don't, I guess they're not princess movies or something, and that's why they don't stick with everyone as much. But it's really good. It's a very Jules Verne-y, very steampunky. They travel in these weird, elaborate submarines and whatnot. Had features Father Guido Sarducci, Nick, so I'm really trying to get you in there. Look, you go over here. I can't even do it.
Yeah, was he fighting the Pope in the Atlanta pizza joint?
Leonard Nimoy is in there.
Who, by the way, if we may point out, Don Novello was related to, I think it was George H.W. Bush's Surgeon General.
Yes.
Antonio Novello.
There's nothing that brain...
The conspiracy, the web, it all ends up in Comet Pizza.
At any rate, anti-colonialist themes for everyone there. It's like, it's better than Avatar. Basically the same story. But yeah, check it out. I don't know, Catherine and Peter, is that like part of your childhood, or you guys had already like graduated to becoming junior Reason staffers in 2001?
I missed it. That's in my Disney movie interregnum period, you know, the between self-consumption and parenting consumption.
Weren't you working at Reason by
then? In 2001?
Catherine?
I was, yeah. But
weren't you an intern?
It was the summer of 2000.
Yeah. So why, I'm asking, why would Matt think you were...
Know,
like
there's
watching
no
Disney
shame
movies either
in
as a child
a
or as a parent.
Disney movie rewatch in your early 20s. Maybe that's your comfort movie. I don't know.
That was also a period of time in which Disney was sort of going through some internal revolutions, trying to reinvent itself, right? Like 6 months before this.
So Matt's like, do you guys emotionally relate to this movie? And Suderman's like, a quick history of Disney.
Right. So, but like 6 months before that movie came out, The Emperor's New Groove came out. And that was a movie that famously went through like 17 different development processes and was like six different movies over the course of a decade before it finally came out. And this was before, you know, this was after Pixar, of course, had started coming out with their own films, but before the kind of Pixar and Princess brands had eaten traditional Disney animation, but after the kind of like classic era of Disney, you know, animated filmmaking that we think of with Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and all that sort of thing. So it is just sort of like an interesting period in Disney's identity and evolution into the entertainment behemoth that it has become today.
Matt, do you still, I have two quick questions directed at you about Disney. First, do you recall growing up during the moment when Disney was terrible? It was like the black hole and stuff. And it was like
the
Disney,
Rescuers was the only
one. Oh, man,
the Rescuers
down under.
Down under is, oh, my God, that is, we need to have a special episode about all of that. But it still stays with me, you know, that anybody can make a comeback if Disney can come back from where it was in the mid to late 70s, where it was the leading example, along with Sears Roebuck, of how America was over. You know, you had a nice run, but fuck it. It was done. But second thing, did both of your daughters like the movie?
Yep.
That's the real question.
They both did. Coco loved the science stuff and Easy liked the hot bad girls. So look, that's more information than anyone needs to know. Thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable. Check out all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcast. If you like what we do as an organization, and you really should, because it's multifaceted and good, go to reason.com/donate, and we'll see you next Monday.